outhouse and one unfortunate cow. Phil's crew had their first scare at Ephrata. On a training flight, they had radio trouble and got lost, flew around in a blind confusion for hours, and ended up landing at nearly midnight in Spokane, half a state away from their slated destination. They'd been missing for 3.5 hours, and the entire West Coast Air Corps had been hunting for them. When Phil stepped off the plane, he got one chewing out from a colonel. When he flew back to Ephrata, he got another, in stereo, from a colonel and major. "I grew a little older that night, sweet, believe me," he wrote to Cece. The panic had been justified, for accidents were common and deadly. Before Louis had begun his bombardier training, he had received a letter from a friend who was an Air Corps cadet. "I guess you read about the cadet and instructor who was killed here last week. The poor devils never had a chance. They stalled their ship while turning from base leg onto landing approach. The ship made a one-turn spin and then really hit the ground. When they hit, it tore their bodies to pieces. The safety belt cut the instructor half in two. All over the wreck part of the airplane, it looked like somebody took and threw about 3 pans of tomatoes and crackers all over it, blood and flesh. They were mangled to bits, couldn't even identify them looking at them." It was a kind of story that was filling the letters of would-be airmen all over the country. Pilot and navigator error, mechanical failure, and bad luck were killing trainees at a stunning rate. In the Army Air Forces, or AAF, there were 52,651 stateside aircraft accidents over the course of the war, killing 14,903 personnel. Though some of these personnel were probably on coastal patrol and other duties, it can be presumed that the vast majority were trainees, killed without ever seeing a combat theater. In the 3 months in which Phil's men trained as a crew, 3,041 AAF planes, more than 33 per day, met with accidents stateside, killing 9 men per day. In subsequent months, death tallies exceeding 500 were common. In August 1943, 590 airmen would die stateside, 19 per day. Louis, Phil, and their crew saw the dying firsthand. In July, Phil's close friend had been killed in a B-24, just after Phil had had dinner with him. On another day, Phil's crew spent part of a rainy morning sitting in a briefing room with another crew as they awaited flights. Both crews went to their planes, but at the last minute, Phil's crew was ordered back. The other crew took off, flew 2 miles, and crashed, killing the pilot and navigator. In October, in Sioux City, another bomber from their group plowed onto a field, killing 2. When he learned that the press was reporting on the crash without giving the crewmen's names, Phil ran out of a meeting to get word to his family that he hadn't been on the plane. The Air Corps did its best to teach men how to survive a crash. Men were drilled in preparing their planes for impact and equipping themselves for post-crash survival. Each man was assigned to a crash station, which in Louis's case was by the waist window behind the right wing. They were also schooled in bailout simulations, jumping from parked planes. Some rolled off the catwalk and dropped through the open bay doors. Others leapt from the waist windows, wondering how, if jumping from an airborne plane, they'd avoid being cut in two by the twin rudders just behind the windows. They were also taught how to ditch or make a controlled landing on water. Phil studied dutifully, but he found the idea of landing a giant bomber on water kind of silly. The training films surely deepened his doubts. In every film, the ditching B-24 broke apart. Training was a crucible, and it transformed Phil's crew. They would not all live through what lay ahead, but the survivors would speak of their good fortune in serving among such skilled men. They worked together with seamless efficiency, and judging by their training scores in the grim business of bombs and bullets, there was no better crew in the squadron. Among surviving crewmen and men from other crews, the warmest praise would be reserved for Phil. B-24s were built for tall pilots, and though Phil needed a cushion to get his feet to the pedals and his eyes over the control panel, by all accounts he was superb at his job. Phil, Louis told a reporter, was a damn swell pilot. The B-24 assigned to Phil's crew had its own personality. It had a valve that oozed fuel into the bomb bay, prompting Pillsbury to develop a nervous habit of pacing the fuselage, sniffing the air. It had a curmudgeonly fuel transfer valve that Pillsbury and Douglas had to finesse into place lest it stick wide open, slow an engine, or trigger a deafening backfire. The fuel gauges were reliable only until the tanks neared empty, at which point they sometimes reported that the plane was magically gaining fuel. One engine, for reasons known only to the plane, was thirstier than the others, so the gauges had to be watched constantly. In time, the men's misgivings about the Liberator fell away. In hundreds of hours of intense training, their plane never failed them. For all its ugliness and quirks, it was a noble thing, rugged and inexhaustible. The ground crewmen felt the same, nursing Phil's plane with affection and fretting while it flew. When it returned, they received it with relief, scolding the crew for any scratches. Airmen talked of flying boxcars, but Phil and Louis dismissed them. Louis described it as our home. On the ground, the crew drank together, swam in the local lakes, and cruised around Ephrata and Sioux City. In the latter, Louis discovered that the enlisted ground crewmen, who had preceded them into town, had convinced the local women that their insignia indicated that they were officers. As Louis set off to right this wrong, Phil pulled night duty at the operations office. Sometime one night, he drifted into a troubled dream. In it, he came home from the war, only to find that Cece had given him up. On a Saturday afternoon in mid-October of 1942, the men of the 372nd were told to pack their bags. Their training was being cut short, and they were being sent to California's Hamilton Field, then rushed overseas. Phil was crestfallen. Cece was about to come see him. He would miss her by 3 days. On October 20th, the squadron flew out of Iowa. At Hamilton Field, an artist was working his way down the plains, painting each one's name and accompanying illustration. Naming bombers was a grand tradition. Many B-24 crews dreamed up delightfully clever names, among them E. Pluribus Aluminum, Axis Grinder, The Bad Penny, and Bombs Nippon. Quite a few of the rest were shamelessly bawdy, painted with scantily clad and unclad women. One featured a sailor chasing a naked girl around the fuselage. Its name was Willie Maker. Louis had a snapshot taken of himself grinning under one of the more ribald examples. Phil's plane needed a name, and no one could think of one. After the war, the survivors would have different memories of who named the plane, but in a letter penned that fall, Phil would write that it was co-pilot George Mosnett who suggested Superman. Everyone liked it, and the name was painted on the plane's nose, along with the superhero himself, a bomb in one hand and a machine gun in the other. Louis didn't think much of the painting. In photographs, the gun looks like a shovel. But Phil loved it. Most crews referred to their planes as she. Phil insisted that his plane was all man. The men were slated for combat, but they hadn't been told where they would serve. Judging by the heavy winter gear, Louis thought that they were bound for Alaska's Aleutian Islands, which had been invaded by the Japanese months before. He was happily wrong. They were going to Hawaii. On the evening of October 24th, Louis called home for a last goodbye. He just missed Pete, who came for a visit only a few minutes after his brother hung up. Sometime after speaking to Louis, Louise pulled out a set of note cards on which she kept lists of Christmas card recipients. After Louis's last visit home, she'd taken out one of the cards and on it jotted down the date and a few words about Louis's departure. This day, she noted Louis's phone call. These were the first two entries in what would become Louise's war diary. Before he left Hamilton Field, Louis dropped a little package in the mail addressed to his mother. When Louise opened it, she found inside a pair of airman's wings. Every morning, through all that lay ahead for her, Louise would pin the wings to her dress. Every night, before she went to bed, she'd take them off her dress and pin them to her nightgown. On November 2nd, 1942, Phil's crew climbed aboard Superman and readied to go to war. They were heading into a desperate fight. North to south, Japan's new empire stretched 5,000 miles, from the snowbound Aleutians to Java, hundreds of miles south of the equator. West to east, the empire sprawled over more than 6,000 miles, from the border of India to the Gilbert and Marshall Islands in the Central Pacific. In the Pacific, virtually everything above Australia and west of the international dateline had been taken by Japan. Only a few eastward islands had been spared. Among them, the Hawaiian Islands, Midway, Canton, Funafuti, and a tiny paradise called Palmyra. It was from these outposts that the men of the AAF were trying to win the Pacific, as the saying went, one damned island after another. That day, Superman banked over the Pacific for the first time. The crew was bound for Oahu's Hickam Field, where the war had begun for America 11 months before, and where it would soon begin for them. The rim of California slid away, and then there was nothing but ocean. From this day forward, until victory or defeat, transfer, discharge, capture, or death took them from it, the vast Pacific would be beneath and around them. Its bottom was already littered with downed warplanes and the ghosts of lost airmen. Every day of this long and ferocious war, more would join them. Chapter 7. This is it, boys. Oahu was still ringing from the Japanese attack. The enemy had left so many holes in the roads that the authorities hadn't been able to fill them all yet, leaving the local drivers swerving around craters. There were still a few gouges in the roof of the Hickam Field barracks, making for soggy airmen when it rained. The island was on constant alert for air raids or invasion, and was so heavily camouflaged, a ground crewman wrote in his diary that one sees only about one-third of what is actually there. Each night, the island disappeared. Every window was fitted with light-proof curtains, every car with covered headlights, and blackout patrols enforced rules so strict that a man wasn't even permitted to strike a match. Servicemen were under orders to carry gas masks in hip holsters at all times. To reach their beloved waves, local surfers had to worm their way under the barbed wire that ran the length of Waikiki Beach. The 372nd Squadron was sent to Kahuku, a beachside base at the foot of a blade of mountains on the north shore. Louis and Phil, who would soon be promoted to first lieutenant, were assigned to a barracks with Mitchell, Mosnet, 12 other young officers, and hordes of mosquitoes. You kill one, Phil wrote, and 10 more come to the funeral. Outside, the building was picturesque. Inside, Phil wrote, it looked like a dozen dirty Missouri pigs had been wallowing on it. The non-stop revelry didn't help matters. After one 4 a.m. knockdown, drag-out water fight involving all 16 officers, Phil woke up with floor burns on his elbows and knees. On another night, as Louis and Phil wrestled over a beer, they crashed into the flimsy partition separating their room from the next. The partition keeled over, and Phil and Louis kept staggering forward, toppling two more partitions before they stopped. When Colonel William Matheny, the 307th Bomb Group commander, saw the wreckage, he grumbled something about how Zamperini must have been involved. There was one perk to life in the barracks. The bathroom was plastered in girly pinups, a Sistine Chapel of pornography. Phil gaped at it, marveling at the distillation of frustrated flyboy libido that had inspired it. Here in the pornographic palace, he was a long way from his minister father's house in Indiana. Everyone was eager to take a crack at the enemy, but there was no combat to be had. In its place were endless lectures, endless training, and when Mosnet was transferred to another crew, the breaking in of a series of temporary co-pilots. Eventually, Long Beach, California native Charlton Hugh Cuppernell joined the crew as Mosnet's replacement. A smart, jovial ex-football player and pre-law student, built like a side of beef, Cuppernell got along with everyone, dispensing wisecracks through teeth clenched around a gnawed-up cigar. When they first went up over Hawaii, the men were surprised to learn that their Arctic gear hadn't been issued in error. At 10,000 feet, even in the tropics, it could be sharply cold, and occasionally the bombardier's greenhouse windows froze. Only the flight deck up front was heated, so the men in the rear tramped around in fleece jackets, fur-lined boots, and sometimes electrically heated suits. The ground crewmen used the bombers as flying iceboxes, hiding soda bottles in them and retrieving them ice-cold after missions. Training mostly over Kauai, the men discovered their talent. Though they had a few mishaps, Phil once taxied Superman straight into a telephone pole. In aerial gunning, they nailed targets at a rate more than 3 times the squadron average. Louis's bombing scores were outstanding. In one dive-bombing exercise, he hit the target dead center 7 of 9 times. The biggest chore of training was coping with the nitpicking, rank-pulling, much-loathed lieutenant who oversaw their flights. Once, when one of Superman's engines quit during a routine flight, Phil turned the plane back and landed at Kahuku, only to be accosted by the furious lieutenant in a speeding Jeep, ordering them back up. When Louis offered to fly on three engines, so long as the lieutenant joined them, the lieutenant abruptly changed his mind. When the men weren't training, they were on sea search, spending 10 hours a day patrolling a wedge of ocean looking for the enemy. It was intensely dull work. Louis killed time by sleeping on Mitchell's navigator table and taking flying lessons from Phil. On some flights, he sprawled behind the cockpit, reading Ellery Queen novels and taxing the nerves of Douglas, who eventually got so annoyed at having to step over Louis's long legs that he attacked him with a fire extinguisher. Once the gunners got so bored, they fired at a pod of whales. Phil yelled at them to knock it off, and the whales swam on, unharmed. The bullets, it turned out, carried lethal speed for only a few feet after entering the water. One day, this would be very useful knowledge. One morning on sea search, Phil's crew passed over an American submarine sitting placidly on the surface, crewmen ambling over the deck. Louis flashed the identification code 3 times, but the sub crew ignored him. Louis and Phil decided to scare the hell out of them. As Louis opened the bomb bay doors, Louis sent the plane screaming down over the submarine. The retreat from the deck was so hasty, it looked like they were sucked into the sub, Louis wrote in his diary. I gave the skipper an F for identification, but an A-plus for a quick dive. The tedium of sea search made practical joking irresistible. When a loudmouth ground officer griped about the higher pay allotted to airmen, the crew invited him to fly the plane himself. During the flight, they sat him in the co-pilot seat, while Louis hid under the navigator's table next to the chains that linked the plane's yokes to the control surfaces. When the officer took the yoke, Louis began tugging the chains, making the plane swoop up and down. The officer panicked. Louis smothered his laughter, and Phil kept a perfect poker face. The officer never again complained about airman's pay. Louis's two proudest moments as a prankster both involved chewing gum. After Cuppernell and Phil swiped Louis's beer, Louis retaliated by sneaking out to Superman and jamming gum into the cockpit piss pipe, the urine relief tube. During that day's flight, the call of nature was followed by an inexplicably brimming piss pipe, turbulence, and at least one wet airman. Louis hid in Honolulu for 2 days to escape retribution. On another day, to get even with Cuppernell and Phil for regularly stealing his chewing gum, Louis replaced his ordinary gum with a laxative variety. Just before a long day of sea search, Cuppernell and Phil each stole 3 pieces, triple the standard dose. As Superman flew over the Pacific that morning, Louis watched with delight as pilot and co-pilot, in great distress, made alternating dashes to the back of the plane, yelling for someone to get a toilet bag ready. On his last run, Cuppernell discovered that all the bags had been used. With nowhere else to go, he dropped his pants and hung his rear end out the waist window while 4 crewmen clung to him to prevent him from falling out. When the ground crew saw the results all over Superman's tail, they were furious. It was like an abstract painting, Louis said later. Phil's remedy for boredom was hot dogging. After each day of sea search, he and another pilot synchronized their returns to Oahu. The one in front would buzz the island with wheels up, seeing how low he could get without skinning the plane's underside, then goad the other into going lower. Phil hummed Superman so close to the ground that he could look straight into the first floor windows of buildings. It was, he said in his strolling cadence, kind of daring. For each day in the air, the crew got a day off. They played poker, divvied up Cece's care packages, and went to the movies. Louis ran laps around the runway, keeping his body in Olympic condition. On the beach at Kahuku, he and Phil inflated their mattress covers, made a go at the waves, and nearly drowned themselves. Tooling around the island in borrowed cars, they came upon several airfields, but when they drew closer, they realized that all of the planes and equipment were fake, made of plywood, an elaborate ruse designed to fool Japanese reconnaissance planes. And in Honolulu, they found their Everest. It was the house of P.Y. Chong, steakhouse, where for $2.50 they could get a steak nearly as fat as a man's arm and as broad as his head. Louis never saw a Chong diner finish his meal. For the officer half of the crew, paradise was Honolulu's North Shore Officers Club, where there were tennis courts, pretty girls with 10:30 curfews, and Boilermakers. When the crew got the best gunnery scores in the squadron, Louis rewarded the enlisted men by pinning his insignia on their uniforms and sneaking them into the club. Just after Louis got up to dance with a girl, Colonel Matheny sat down in his place and began talking to the terrified Clarence Douglas, who was pretending to be a second lieutenant. When Louis finally got free and ran to Douglas's rescue, the unsuspecting colonel stood up and told him what a damn fine man Douglas was. One day on the club's dance floor, Louis spotted the lieutenant who had ordered them to fly on three engines. He scrounged up a bag of flour, recruited a girl, and began dancing in circles near the lieutenant, dropping a pinch of flour down the officer's collar each time he swung past. After an hour of this, the whole club was watching. Finally, Louis snagged a glass of water, danced up behind his victim, dumped the water down his shirt, and took off. The lieutenant spun around, his back running with dough. Unable to find the culprit, he stormed out, and Louis was the toast of the club. "We had one more girl for us," he said. November became December, and the crew still hadn't seen any Japanese. There was hard fighting down on Guadalcanal, and the men felt excluded, frustrated, and intensely curious about combat. Every time a B-17 was brought up from the fighting, Louis and his friends went to the airfield to gawk at it. At first, all the planes looked the same. Then an airman showed them a lone bullet hole. "My golly," Louis said later, "our hair stood on end." 3 days before Christmas, the crew's hour finally came. They and 25 other crews were told to pack 3 days' worth of clothes and report to their planes. Walking out to Superman, Louis found the bomb bay fitted with two auxiliary fuel tanks and 6 500-pound bombs. Judging by the auxiliary tanks, Louis wrote in his diary, their destination was likely a long hop somewhere. Instead of the Norden bomb site, Louis was given a handheld site, which probably meant that they'd be dive bombing. The crew was handed a packet of orders and told not to open them until airborne. 5 minutes after Superman lifted off, the crewmen tore open the orders and learned that they were to make a heading for Midway. When they landed there, 8 hours later, they were greeted with a case of Budweiser and very big news. The Japanese had built a base on Wake Atoll. In the biggest raid yet staged in the Pacific War, the AAF was going to burn the base down. The next afternoon, the crew was called to the briefing room, which was actually the base theater, strung with limp Christmas tinsel and streamers. They were going to hit Wake that night with dive bombing. The mission would take 16 hours nonstop, the longest combat flight the war had yet seen. This would push the B-24s as far as they could go. Even with auxiliary fuel tanks, they would be cutting it extremely close. Before the flight, Louis walked to the airfield. The ground crewmen were preparing the planes, stripping out every ounce of excess weight and rolling black paint on the bellies and wings to make them harder to see against the night sky. Coming to Superman, Louis climbed into the bomb bay where the bombs sat ready. In honor of his college buddy, Peyton Jordan, who had just married his high school sweetheart, Louis scrawled Marge and Peyton Jordan on a bomb. At 4 o'clock p.m. on December 23rd, 1942, 26 B-24s laden with some 73,000 gallons of fuel and 75,000 pounds of bombs rose up from Midway. Superman slipped toward the rear of the procession. All afternoon and into the evening, the planes flew toward Wake. The sun set and the bombers pressed on under the timid glow of moon and stars. At 11 p.m., when his plane was about 150 miles from Wake, Phil switched off the outside lights. Clouds closed in. The bombers were supposed to approach the atoll in formation, but with clouds around and the lights off, the pilots couldn't find their flight mates. They couldn't risk breaking radio silence, so each plane went on alone. The pilots craned into the dark, swerving away from the faint shadows of others, trying to avoid collisions. Wake was very close now, but they couldn't see it. Sitting in the top turret of Superman, Stanley Pillsbury wondered if he'd make it back alive. In the greenhouse below, Louis felt a buzzing inside himself, the same sensation that he had felt before races. Ahead, Wake slept. At exactly midnight, Colonel Matheny, piloting the lead plane, Dumbo the Avenger, broke radio silence. "This is it, boys." Matheny dropped Dumbo's nose and sent the bomber plunging out of the clouds. There, beneath him, was Wake, three slender islands joining hands around a lagoon. As his co-pilot called out speed and altitude figures, Matheny pushed his plane toward a string of buildings on Peacock Point, the atoll's southern tip. On either side of Matheny's plane, B-24s followed him down. When he reached his bombing altitude, Matheny hauled the plane's nose up and yelled to the bombardier, "When are you going to turn loose those incendiaries?" "Gone, sir." At that instant, the buildings on Peacock Point exploded. It was 45 seconds past midnight. Matheny tipped his bomber and looked down. Peacock Point, struck by Dumbo's bombs and those of its flanking planes, was engulfed in fire. Matheny knew he'd been lucky. The Japanese had been caught sleeping, and no one had yet manned the anti-aircraft guns. As Matheny turned back toward Midway, wave after wave of B-24s dove at Wake. The Japanese ran for their guns. Up in Superman, well behind and above Matheny's plane, Louis saw broad, quick throbs of light in the clouds. He hit the bomb bay door control valve and the doors rumbled open. He set his bomb rack on the select position, flipped on his bomb switches, and fixed the settings. Phil's orders were to dive to 4,000 feet before dropping the bombs, but when he reached that altitude, he was still lost in clouds. Louis's target was the airstrip, but he couldn't see it. Phil pushed the plane still lower, moving at terrific speed. Suddenly, at 2,500 feet, Superman speared through the clouds and Wake stretched out, sudden and brilliant, beneath it. Pillsbury would never shake the memory of what he saw. It looked like a star storm, he remembered. The islands, sealed in blackness a moment before, were a blaze of garish light. Several large infernos spewing black smoke were consuming the atoll's oil tanks. Everywhere, bombs were striking targets, sending up mushrooms of fire. Searchlights swung about, their beams reflecting off the clouds and back onto the ground, illuminating scores of Japanese wearing only fundoshi undergarments, sprinting around in confusion. What neither Pillsbury nor any of the other airmen knew was that among the men under their bombers that night were 98 Americans who had been captured and enslaved. Waist and tail gunners in the bombers fired downward, and one by one the searchlights blew to pieces. To Pillsbury, every gun in the world seemed to be firing skyward. Anti-aircraft guns lobbed shells over the planes, where they erupted, sending shrapnel showering down. Tracers from the firing above and below streaked the air in yellow, red, and green. As Pillsbury watched the clamor of colors, he thought of Christmas. Then he remembered. They had crossed the international dateline and passed midnight. It was Christmas. Phil wrestled Superman out of its dive. As the plane leveled off, Louis spotted the taillight of a Zero rolling down the north-south runway. He began synchronizing on the light, hoping to hit the Zero before it took off. Below, very close, something exploded, and Superman rocked. A shell burst by the left wing, another by the tail. Louis could see tracers cutting neat lines in the sky to the right. He loosed a bomb over the south end of the runway, counted 2 seconds, then dropped his five other bombs over a set of bunkers and parked planes beside the runway. Relieved of 3,000 pounds of bombs, Superman bobbed upward. Louis yelled, "Bombs away!" And Phil rolled the plane roughly to the left through streams of anti-aircraft fire. Louis looked down. His group of five bombs landed in splashes of fire on the bunkers and planes. He'd been a beat too late to hit the Zero. His bomb fell just behind it, lighting up the runway. Phil turned Superman back for Midway. Wake was a sea of fire and running men. The crew was jumpy, coursing with adrenaline. There were several Zeros in the air, but in the darkness, no one knew where they were. Somewhere in the galaxy of planes, a Zero fired on a bomber, which fired back. The Zero disappeared. Pillsbury looked to the side and saw yellow dashes of tracer fire heading directly toward them. A B-24 gunner had mistaken them for an enemy plane and was firing on them. Phil saw it just as Pillsbury did and swung the plane away. The firing stopped. The bomb bay doors were stuck open. The motors strained but couldn't budge them. Louis climbed back and looked. When Phil had wrenched the plane out of its dive, the enormous G-forces had nudged the auxiliary fuel tanks out of place, just enough to block the doors. Nothing could be done. With the bomb bay yawning open and dragging against the air, the plane was burning much more fuel than usual. Given that this mission was stretching the plane's range to the limit, it was sobering news. The men could do nothing but wait and hope. They passed around pineapple juice and roast beef sandwiches. Louis was drained, both from the combat and the incessant quivering of the plane. He stared out, sleepy, watching the stars through breaks in the clouds. 75 miles away from Wake, one of the men looked back. He could still see the island burning. As day broke over the Pacific, Brigadier General Howard K. Ramey stood by the Midway airstrip, looking at the clouds and waiting for his bombers. His face was furrowed. A brow of fog hung 200 feet over the ocean, spilling rain. In some places, visibility was down to a few yards. Finding tiny, flat Midway would be difficult, and there was the question of whether the bombers' fuel would last long enough to bring them home. One plane appeared, then another and another. One by one, they landed, all critically low on fuel, one with a dead engine. Superman wasn't in sight. Out in the fog, Phil must have looked at his fuel gauge and known that he was in real trouble. With his bomb bay open and wind howling through the fuselage, he had dragged away most of his fuel and was running on empty. He didn't know if he'd be able to find Midway, and he didn't have enough fuel to make a second pass. At last, at around 8 a.m., he saw Midway dimly through the mist. A moment later, one of Superman's engines sputtered and died. Phil knew that the other engines would quit almost immediately. He nursed the plane along, spotting the runway and aiming for it. The engines kept turning. Phil dropped Superman and touched down. Just after the plane turned off the runway, a second engine died. As it reached its bunker, the other two engines quit. Had the route been only slightly longer, Superman would have hit the ocean. General Ramey ran to each bomber, calling out congratulations. The tired Superman crewmen dropped out of the plane and into a mob of Marines who'd spent a year waiting to deliver retribution to the Japanese for what they had done to their brothers at Wake. The Marines passed out shots of liquor and fêted the airmen. The mission had been a smashing success. Every plane had returned safely. Only one bomb had missed its target, plopping into the water 20 feet offshore. The Japanese base had been gravely damaged. By one estimate, half of its personnel had been killed, and America had demonstrated the reach and power of its B-24s. And though the men didn't know it, the American captives had all survived. Phil's crew spent the day sitting in the rain, watching several albatrosses make comically inept attempts at landing on the flooded runway. Early the next morning, Superman carried them back to Kahuku. Louis spent New Year's Eve at a party with Maznet and his bombardier, James Carringer, Jr., and didn't drag himself back to the pornographic palace until 4:30. He pulled himself together a few hours later when Admiral Chester Nimitz presented the Wake pilots with distinguished flying crosses and their crewmen with air medals. News of the raid broke, and the men were lauded as heroes. The press played up their Christmas gift to the Allies. "Steel fills Jap's socks," read one headline. In Tokyo, radio broadcasters had a different take. They reported that the Americans, upon encountering Japanese defenses, had fled in terror. In the Honolulu Advertiser, Louis found a cartoon depicting his role in bombing Wake. He clipped it out and tucked it in his wallet. With the dawn of 1943 and the success at Wake, the men felt cocky. It had all been so easy. One admiral predicted that Japan might be finished within the year, and Phil overheard men talking about going home. "Methinks," he wrote to his mother, "it's a little premature." Chapter 8. Only the laundry knew how scared I was. It was early morning on January 8, 1943. The sun hadn't yet risen. George Maznet and James Carringer, who had spent New Year's Eve with Louis, joined their crew at the beachside airstrip at Barking Sands on Kauai, preparing to lead a 3-plane training run over Pearl Harbor. The pilot was Major Jonathan Coxwell, one of Phil's closest friends. As he taxied out for his flight, Coxwell tried to reach the control tower, but the tower's radio was down. He powered his plane down the runway, lifted off, and flew over the beach and into the darkness. The two other planes took off after Coxwell. Later that morning, they returned. Coxwell's plane did not. No one had seen it since takeoff. During a briefing at 8, Louis was told that Coxwell's plane was missing. Phil's crew was slated for practice bombing off Barking Sands that morning, so they went early and walked the beach, looking for some sign of their friends. Someone found a $400 paycheck that had washed ashore. It was made out to Maznet. The Superman crew was 15,000 feet up when the lost B-24 was found, lying on the ocean floor, not far offshore. All 10 crewmen were dead. Coxwell had barely made it past takeoff. He had cleared the runway, turned, and slammed into the water. Several crewmen had survived the crash and tried to swim to land, but the sharks had found them. The men were, Louis wrote in his diary, literally ripped to pieces. 5, including Mosnet, had lived in the pornographic palace with Louis and Phil. Derringer had just been promoted to first lieutenant, but had died before anyone could tell him. They were buried in the cemetery in Honolulu, joining the men killed at Pearl Harbor. Louis was shaken. He'd been in Hawaii for only 2 months, yet already several dozen men from his bomb group, including more than a quarter of the men in his barracks, had been killed. The first loss had come on the flight from San Francisco, when a B-24 had simply vanished. This fate was sadly common. Between 1943 and 1945, 400 AAF crews were lost en route to their theaters. Next, a plane had caught fire and crashed in Kahuku, killing 4 men. Another plane had hit a mountain. A bomber had been forced down after losing all 4 engines, killing 2. In one bomber, a green engineer transferring fuel across the wings had caused gasoline to pool on the floor of the bomb bay. When the bomb bay doors had scraped open, igniting a spark, the plane exploded. 3 men had survived, including a passenger whose hand had happened to be resting on a parachute when the blast flung him from the plane. After the Wake raid, a plane sent to photograph the damage had been hit by anti-aircraft fire. The crew had sent out a last message, "Can't make it," and was never heard from again. Then had come Coxwell's crash. These losses, only one due to enemy action, were hardly anomalous. In World War II, 35,933 AAF planes were lost in combat and accidents. The surprise of the attrition rate is that only a fraction of the ill-fated planes were lost in combat. In 1943, in the Pacific Ocean Area's theater, in which Phil's crew served, for every plane lost in combat, some 6 planes were lost in accidents. Over time, combat took a greater toll, but combat losses never overtook non-combat losses. As planes went, so went men. In the Air Corps, 35,946 personnel died in non-battle situations, the vast majority of them in accidental crashes. Even in combat, airmen appear to have been more likely to die from accidents than combat itself. A report issued by the AAF Surgeon General suggests that in the 15th Air Force, between November 1, 1943, and May 25, 1945, 70% of men listed as killed in action died in operational aircraft accidents, not as a result of enemy action. In many cases, the problem was the planes, in part because they were new technology, and in part because they were used so heavily, planes were prone to breakdowns. In January 1943 alone, Louis recorded in his diary 10 serious mechanical problems in Superman and other planes in which he flew, including 2 in-flight engine failures, a gas leak, oil pressure problems, and landing gear that locked, fortunately, in the down position. Once, Superman's brakes failed on landing. By the time Phil got the plane stopped, the bomber was 3 feet short of the runway's end. Just beyond it lay the ocean. The weather also took a toll. Storms reduced visibility to 0, a major problem for pilots searching for tiny islands or threading through the mountains that flanked some Hawaiian runways. B-24s were hard to manage even in smooth skies. In some tropical tempests, not even the combined strength of pilot and co-pilot could keep the plane in hand. 2 times in 1 week, Superman flew into storms that buffeted the plane so violently that Phil lost control. Once, the plane was flung around the sky for 10 minutes, leaving the temporary co-pilot so paralyzed with fear that Phil had to call Louis to take his place. One day, after sea search, as Phil was detouring around a squall, Cuppernell asked him if he'd dare fly into it. "I can fly this thing anywhere," Phil said, turning the plane into the storm. Superman was instantly swallowed, and Phil could see nothing. Rain drummed on the plane, wind pivoted it sideways, and it began porpoising, leaving the crewmen clinging to anything bolted down. They had only been at 1,000 feet when they'd flown into the storm. Now the plane was pitching so erratically that they couldn't read their altitude. And with no visibility, they didn't know where the ocean was. Each time the plane plunged, the men braced for a crash. Oahu had been in sight before they entered the storm, but now they had no idea where it was. Phil gripped the yoke, sweat streaming down his face. Pillsbury strapped on his parachute. Riding the bucking plane at his radio table, Harry Brooks picked up a signal from a Hawaiian radio station. The plane was equipped with a radio compass that enabled Harry to determine the direction from which the signal was coming. Phil strong-armed the plane around and headed toward it. They broke out of the storm, found the airfield, and landed. Phil was exhausted, his shirt wringing wet. The runways were another headache. Many islands were so short that engineers had to plow coral onto one end to create enough length for a runway. Even with the amendments, there often wasn't enough space. After long missions, groups of planes occasionally came back so low on fuel that none of them could wait for the others to land, so they'd land simultaneously, with the lead pilot delaying his touchdown until he was far enough down the runway for the planes behind him to land at the same time. So many planes shot off the end of Funafuti's runway and into the ocean that the ground crews kept a bulldozer equipped with a towing cable parked by the water. For loaded B-24s, which needed well over 4,000 feet for takeoff, the cropped island runways, often abutted by towering palm trees, were a challenge. "The takeoff proved exciting," wrote Staff Sergeant Frank Rozenek of one overloaded departure. "Six of us had to stand on the narrow beam between the bomb bay doors with our arms spread out on each side over the tops of the twin auxiliary fuel tanks. The smell of the high-octane aviation fuel was almost intoxicating. The plane lumbered down the runway for an eternity, and we could see the hard-packed coral through the cracks where the bomb bay doors came up against the beam we were standing on, 1 foot in front of the other. There was a swoosh, and pieces of palm fronds suddenly appeared jammed in the cracks on both sides. Only the laundry knew how scared I was." And then there was human error. Pilots flew or drove their planes into each other. In B-24s, notorious for fuel leaks, airmen lit cigarettes and blew up their planes. On one flight, when Superman's number 3 engine died, Pillsbury found the temporary co-pilot, oblivious, sitting with his boot resting against the engine's ignition switch, pushing it into the off position. Louis was once asked to join a crew whose bombardier had gotten sick. Louis, too, was feeling ill, so the crew found another man. During the flight, the tower warned the pilot that he was heading toward a mountain. The pilot replied that he saw it, then flew right into it. The strangest incident occurred when a bomber made a sharp pull-up on a training run. A man inside, trying to avoid falling, inadvertently grabbed the life raft release handle. The raft sprang from the roof and wrapped around the plane's horizontal stabilizer. Barely able to control the plane, the pilot ordered his men to bail out. He and his co-pilot somehow landed safely, and everyone survived. Finally, there was the formidable difficulty of navigation. Making extraordinarily complex spherical trigonometry calculations based on figures taken from a crowd of instruments, navigators groped over thousands of miles of featureless ocean toward targets or destination islands that were blacked out at night, often only yards wide and flat to the horizon. Even with all the instruments, the procedures could be comically primitive. "Each time I made a sextant calibration," wrote navigator John Weller, "I would open the escape hatch on the flight deck and stand on my navigation desk and the radio operator's desk while the radio man held onto my legs so I would not be sucked out of the plane. At night, navigators sometimes resorted to following the stars, guiding their crews over the Pacific by means not so different from those used by ancient Polynesian mariners. In a storm or clouds, even that was impossible." Given that a plane had to be only a tick off course to miss an island, it's amazing that any crews found their destinations. Many didn't. Martin Cohn, an ordnance officer on Oahu, was once in a radar shack as a lost plane, unequipped with radar, tried to find the island. "We just sat there and watched the plane pass the island, and it never came back," he said. "I could see it on the radar. It makes you feel terrible. Life was cheap in war." The risks of flying were compounded exponentially in combat. From the sky came Japanese fighters, chief among them the swift, agile Zero, which dominated the sky in the first half of the war. Zero pilots pummeled bombers with machine gun fire and massively destructive 20-millimeter cannon shells, which rammed gaping holes in their targets. When these failed, some Zero pilots rammed their planes into bombers, kamikaze style. One B-24 returned to base with half of a Zero hanging from his wing. From the ground came anti-aircraft fire, including flak, which burst into razor-sharp metal shards that sliced planes open. To survive AA fire and enemy aircraft, bomber pilots needed to change their altitude and direction constantly. But on approach, the Norden bombsight, not the pilot, flew the plane, so evasive action was impossible. B-24s were in the control of the bombsight for 3 to 5 minutes on approach. Japanese rangefinders needed less than 60 seconds to pinpoint bomber altitude. The math favored the Japanese. In combat, bombers even posed risks to one another. To fend off fighter attack and hit narrow target islands, planes had to bunch very close together. In the chaos, planes collided, fired on each other, and worse. In one incident, 3 B-24s on a mission to mine a harbor flew in tight formation through a narrow canyon at 50 feet under intense ground fire. As they dropped over the harbor, the right wingtip of a plane piloted by Lieutenant Robert Strong struck the greenhouse window on the plane to his right, piloted by a Lieutenant Robinson. The collision rotated Strong's bomber onto its left side and under Robinson's plane, just as Robinson's bombardier dropped a 1,000-pound mine. The mine crashed into Strong's plane, and though it didn't detonate, it tore an 18-square-foot hole in the fuselage and lodged itself just behind the waist gunners. Strong's B-24 was nearly cut in two, and the mine's parachute deployed, dragging the plane down. Crewmen cut the parachute free and shoved at the mine, but it wouldn't budge, so they dismantled their guns and used the barrels to crowbar the mine out. As Strong tried to get the nearly bisected plane home, the tail flapped in the wind and a huge crack crept up the fuselage. Impossibly, Strong flew his Liberator 800 miles and landed. When Jesse Stay, a pilot in Louis' squadron, went to see the bomber, he was nearly able to pull its tail off with one hand. The risks of combat created grim statistics. In World War II, 52,173 AAF men were killed in combat. According to Stay, who would become a squadron commander, airmen trying to fulfill the 40 combat missions that made up a Pacific bomber crewman's tour of duty had a 50% chance of being killed. Along with safe return, injury, and death, airmen faced another possible fate. During the war, thousands of airmen vanished, some during combat missions, some on routine flights. Many had been swallowed by the ocean. Some were alive, but lost on the sea or islands. And some had been captured. Unable to find them, the military declared them missing. If they weren't found within 13 months, they were declared dead. Most of the time, stricken Pacific bombers came down on water, either by ditching or by crashing. Crewmen who crashed were very unlikely to survive, but ditching offered better odds, depending on the bomber. The B-17 and its soon-to-be-introduced cousin, the gigantic B-29, had wide, low wings that, with the fuselage, formed a relatively flat surface that could surf onto water. Their sturdy bomb bay doors sat flush to the fuselage, intended to hold in a ditching, enabling the plane to float. The first ditched B-29 not only survived, it floated onto an Indian beach completely intact the following day. The B-24 was another story. Its wings were narrow and mounted high on the fuselage, and its delicate bomb bay doors protruded slightly from the bottom of the plane. In most B-24 ditchings, the bomb bay doors would catch on the water and tear off, and the plane would blow apart. Less than a quarter of ditched B-17s broke up, but a survey of B-24 ditchings found that nearly two-thirds broke up and a quarter of the crewmen died. For B-24 survivors, quick escape was crucial. Without sealed fuselages, Liberators sank instantly. One airman recalled watching his ditched B-24 sink so quickly that he could still see its lights when it was far below the surface. Every airman was given a Mae West life vest, but because some men stole the vest's carbon dioxide cartridges for use in carbonating drinks, some vests didn't inflate. Life rafts were deployed manually. From inside the plane, crewmen could pull a release handle just before ditching or crashing. From outside a floating plane, they could climb on the wings and turn raft release levers. Once deployed, rafts inflated automatically. Survivors had to get to rafts immediately. Airmen would later speak of sharks arriving almost the moment that their planes struck the water. In 1943, Navy Lieutenant Art Redding, Louis' USC track teammate, was knocked unconscious as he ditched his two-man plane. As the plane sank, Redding's navigator, Everett Almond, pulled Redding out, inflated their May Wests, and lashed himself to Redding. As Redding woke, Almond began towing him toward the nearest island, 20 miles away. Sharks soon began circling. One swept in, bit down on Almond's leg, and dove, dragging both men deep underwater. Then something gave way and the men rose to the surface in a pool of blood. Almond's leg had apparently been torn off. He gave his May West to Redding, then sank away. For the next 18 hours, Redding floated alone, kicking at the sharks and hacking at them with his binoculars. By the time a search boat found him, his legs were slashed and his jaw broken by the fin of a shark. But thanks to Almond, he was alive. Almond, who had died at 21, was nominated for a posthumous medal for bravery. Everyone had heard stories like Redding's, and everyone had looked from their planes to see sharks roaming below. The fear of sharks was so powerful that most men, faced with the choice of riding a crippled plane to a ditching or bailing out, chose to take their chances in a ditching, even in the B-24. At least that would leave them near the rafts. The military was dedicated to finding crash and ditching survivors, but in the sprawling Pacific theater, the odds of rescue were extremely daunting. Many doomed planes sent no distress call, and often no one knew a plane was down until it missed its estimated time of arrival, which could be as long as 16 hours after the crash. If the absence went unnoticed until night, an air search couldn't be commenced until morning. In the meantime, raft-bound men struggled with injuries and exposure and drifted far from their crash site. For rescuers, figuring out where to look was tremendously difficult. To keep radio silence, many crews didn't communicate any position during flights. So all searchers had to go on was the course the plane would have followed had everything gone right. But downed planes had often been flying over huge distances and may have veered hundreds of miles off course. Once a plane was down, currents and wind could carry a raft dozens of miles a day. Because of this, search areas often extended over thousands of square miles. The longer rafts floated, the farther they drifted, and the worse the odds of rescue became. The most heartbreaking fact was that if searchers were lucky enough to fly near a raft, chances were good that they wouldn't see it. Rafts for small planes were the size of small bathtubs. Those for large planes were the length of a reclining man. Though search planes generally flew at just 1,000 feet, even from that height, a raft could easily be mistaken for a white cap or a glint of light. On days with low clouds, nothing could be seen at all. Many planes used for rescue searches had high stall speeds, so they had to be flown so fast that crewmen barely had a moment to scan each area before it was gone behind them. In mid-1944, in response to the dismal results of Pacific rescue searches, the AAF implemented a vastly enhanced rescue system. Life rafts were stocked with radios and better provisions. Boats were set out along paths flown by military planes, and searches were handled by designated rescue squadrons equipped with float planes. These advances improved the odds of rescue, but even after their advent, most downed men were never found. According to reports made by the Far East Air Force air surgeon, fewer than 30% of men whose planes went missing between July 1944 and February 1945 were rescued. Even when the plane's location was known, only 46% of men were saved. In some months, the picture was far worse. In January 1945, only 21 of 167 downed 21st Bomber Command airmen were rescued, just 13%. As bleak as these odds were late in the war, men who went down before mid-1944 faced far worse. Flying before the rescue system was modernized, they faced a situation in which searches were disorganized, life rafts poorly equipped, and procedures ineffective. Everyone on Phil's crew knew that should they go down, their chances of rescue were very low. The improbability of rescue, coupled with the soaring rate of accidental crashes, created a terrible equation. Search planes appear to have been more likely to go down themselves than find the men they were looking for. In one time frame, in the Eastern Air Command, half of the Catalina flying boats attempting rescues crashed while trying to land on the ocean. It seems likely that for every man rescued, several would-be rescuers died, especially in the first years of the war. With every day that passed without rescue, the prospects for raft-bound men worsened dramatically. Raft provisions lasted a few days at most. Hunger, thirst, and exposure to blistering sun by day and chill by night depleted survivors with frightening rapidity. Some men died in days, others went insane. In September 1942, a B-17 crashed in the Pacific, stranding 9 men on a raft. Within a few days, one had died, and the rest had gone mad. 2 heard music and baying dogs. 1 was convinced that a Navy plane was pushing the raft from behind. 2 scuffled over an imaginary case of beer. Another shouted curses at a sky that he believed was full of bombers. Seeing a delusory boat, he pitched himself overboard and drowned. On day 6, when a plane flew by, the remaining men had to confer to be sure that it was real. When they were rescued on day 7, they were too weak to wave their arms. There were fates even worse than this. In February 1942, a wooden raft was found drifting near Christmas Island in the Indian Ocean. Upon it was the body of a man, lying in a makeshift coffin that appeared to have been built on the raft. The man's boiler suit had been in the sun for so long that its blue fabric had been bleached white. A shoe that didn't belong to the man lay beside him. No one ever determined who he was or where he had come from. Of all the horrors facing downed men, the one outcome that they feared most was capture by the Japanese. The roots of the men's fear lay in an event that occurred in 1937, in the early months of Japan's invasion of China. The Japanese military surrounded the city of Nanking, stranding more than 500,000 civilians and 90,000 Chinese soldiers. The soldiers surrendered, and, assured of their safety, submitted to being bound. Japanese officers then issued a written order: all prisoners of war are to be executed. What followed was a 6-week frenzy of killing that defies articulation. Masses of POWs were beheaded, machine-gunned, bayoneted, and burned alive. The Japanese turned on civilians, engaging in killing contests, raping tens of thousands of people, mutilating and crucifying them, and provoking dogs to maul them. Japanese soldiers took pictures of themselves posing alongside hacked-up bodies, severed heads, and women strapped down for rape. The Japanese press ran tallies of the killing contests as if they were baseball scores, praising the heroism of the contestants. Historians estimate that the Japanese military murdered between 200,000 and 430,000 Chinese, including the 90,000 POWs, in what became known as the Rape of Nanking. Every American airman knew about Nanking, and since then, Japan had only reinforced the precedent. Among the men of Louis' squadron, there was a rumor circulating about the atoll of Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands, a Japanese territory. On Kwajalein, the rumor said POWs were murdered. The men called it Execution Island. It is testament to the reputation of the Japanese that of all the men in one fatally damaged B-24 falling over Japanese forces, only one chose to bail out. The rest were so afraid of capture that they chose to die in the crash. For airmen, the risks were impossible to shrug off. The dead weren't numbers on a page. They were their roommates, their drinking buddies, the crew that had been flying off their wing 10 seconds ago. Men didn't go one by one. A quarter of a barracks was lost at once. There were rarely funerals, for there were rarely bodies. Men were just gone, and that was the end of it. Airmen avoided the subject of death, but privately, many were tormented by fear. One man in Louis' squadron had chronic stress-induced nosebleeds. Another had to be relieved because he froze with terror in the air. Pilot Joe Deasy recalled a distraught airman who came to him with a question. If a crewman went mad during a mission, would the crew shoot him? The man was so jittery that he accidentally fired his sidearm into the ground as he spoke.